Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true? They don't think Christianity's true. They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
Are scientists always objective? Are they completely pure in their motives? Are there gatekeepers in mainstream science? How about the world of biology? Through what lens do mainstream biologists interpret the evidence? Are they open to evidence that suggests an intelligent designer exists? Or, if you're a scientist, will you be censored if you suggest that? What is undeniable in the debate between evolutionists and intelligent design proponents? What is the gaping hole in evolutionary theory? What atheists are beginning to admit that their naturalistic worldview can't explain what we observe around us? And the biggest question is this: to what or to whom do we owe our existence? That's the subject of a recent book called Undeniable: How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed. And my guest is Dr. Doug Axe. Doug has been on the program before. In fact, he and Stephen Meyer were on about 6 months ago when we discussed the Royal Society meeting in London, which occurred back last November. Doug is the director of the Biologic Institute, a nonprofit research organization affiliated with the Discovery Institute in Seattle. His undergraduate studies, he actually survived UC Berkeley. He went to UCal Berkeley. He did doctoral work at Caltech. He did postdoctoral work and research work at the University of Cambridge. His work and ideas have been featured in many scientific journals, including the Journal of Molecular Biology, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Nature, and several others. And he has written this fabulous recent book called Undeniable. Doug, great to have you back on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Now, Doug, this book has gotten a lot of attention. It's a very good book that you've just written in the past year or so, and I've just had the opportunity in the past couple of weeks to read through it. And it is something that I think everyone should read who is interested in this issue. When you say undeniable, what do you mean by that? What is undeniable in the world of biology?
Well, what I mean by that is the design intuition that we all seem to have from a very early age. I quote actually a Berkeley psychology professor, Alvin Gopnik, in the book, as saying that by elementary school age, children start to invoke a godlike designer to explain the complexity of the world around them, even children brought up as atheists. And so we all, regardless of our upbringing, when we look at living things, we intuit that they were made by a godlike designer. And, you know, some intuitions are good and some are not so good. I don't at all argue that we should always believe intuitions, but I show in the book that this particular intuition, the design intuition, is correct. And so that's what I am referring to as being undeniable.
Now, Richard Dawkins agrees with you in the sense that he said, I think way back in The Blind Watchmaker, he said something like biological entities have the appearance of being designed for a purpose. But then he goes on to say it's just an appearance. It's not really true. And this is the subject of the entire book. But if you could just give us an example as to why you say the intuition is true. What would be an example from the book that you would say, hey, this is very strong? I know you talk in there a little bit about pond scum. That's not the technical name for it, but you have example after example in the book, Undeniable. Just pick one to describe to our audience as to why you think the design intuition is actually a good intuition.
Well, I make an argument in the book over several chapters, and I try to make the argument in a way that does not require any scientific background whatsoever. And so I've gone to the lab and convinced myself and hopefully others doing technical research that Darwin's explanation of life doesn't work all the way down at the level of single genes and the protein molecules that they encode. They can't actually be invented by this accidental Darwinian process. But in bringing that news to non-technical readers, I really wanted to connect it to more obvious things. When you look at, when I give talks, I show a picture of an origami crane. So there's a good example. And I say, if a child sees this folded piece of paper on a table and has no idea where it came from, he or she immediately knows that somebody made that. That's a piece of paper, but somebody did something clever to it. And that's an intuition. That's an example of this design intuition. And what is the child thinking? They're thinking, how was this done? Show me how to do it. I want to make an origami crane out of paper. That same sort of reasoning is almost immediate. It's not like the child has to sit down and do a calculation or ponder it. That same immediate impression comes when the child looks at a real crane or at a cat or a dog or a butterfly. What I show in the book is that there's an argument from probability or extreme improbability. And it's not that the child is actually doing this. It's that it's almost automatic. The improbability of things like this happening by accident is so extreme, you don't even have to talk about the numbers. They're so off the charts improbable that they just can't happen by accident. So lots of examples in the book. The pond scum is one of them. Mm-hmm. Cyanobacteria is the technical term. But what I'm really trying to do with cyanobacteria and some of the other biological examples is just show pictures of how staggeringly complicated, beautifully complicated, not like a complicated mess, but like something, a gorgeous example of engineering is what you see when you peel away the layers and look at how these things work, even the very simplest forms of life, like cyanobacteria.
In fact, I think you actually compare the pond scum example to a pool cleaner, if I'm not mistaken. I think the machine called a pool cleaner actually is primitive compared to what pond scum can do. Am I making the right connection here?
I actually compare the pond scum to this robotic device called Tavros 2. It was something that was designed at the University of Florida.
They use it
to do missions in the Gulf of Mexico. And so this robotic thing about the size of a table has solar panels on the top. It solar charges itself, and then it goes to particular longitude, latitude coordinates, and then descends down to a certain depth in the Gulf and measures things like temperature and alkalinity of the water as it goes down. And then when it needs to recharge, it comes back up and recharges, and then it goes to its next location. Well, you compare that large thing that was put together by humans in factories, you know, all kinds of components that were made in factories and put together, to this little microscopic bacterium that also uses solar energy to power itself, but moves in a much more sophisticated way. And oh, by the way, it makes more of itself. Whereas this robotic thing that humans make, we have to go into labs and into factories to make all the parts to put these things together. They don't really make anything. They just move around and do the things that we program them to do. Whereas cyanobacteria have this marvelous suite of capabilities that go so far beyond the things that humans make, the most profound of which is making more of itself.
Which it doesn't happen by accident, and that's your point about the design intuition. Yeah, I read that section about 2 weeks ago, and I was confusing it with a pool cleaner, but I remember it now.
There is a pool cleaner in the book.
I'm getting it mixed up, Doug. It's undeniable. I'm confused right now.
Spider in the pool cleaner.
the spider in the pool cleaner. That's it.
Yeah.
You have example after example. These are common examples. That's why this book, friends, Undeniable by my Doug Axe, is somebody anybody can understand. Now, there's a chapter or two there where you get a little bit down in the weeds, but you don't have to read all that in order to get the point. And the book is called Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. And you can listen to Doug. He was on this program before with Stephen Meyer about 6 months ago. And he is pointing out that there are so many issues in biology that seem to point naturally to a designer that it's just basic intuition. And he does some of the math, too, to show you why it's not just basic intuition. It's fantastically improbable that any of this would happen by just basic natural laws. We'll talk more about that when we come back from the break. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the American Family Radio Network. Our website, crossexamined.org. Cross Examined with a D on the end of it. We're back in 2 minutes.
Thank you for listening to the Cross Examine podcast. This material is made available to you for free by the contributions of listeners like you. If you wish to support future podcasts, just go to crossexamine.org and click on the donate button, or simply use the donate feature directly on our app. Thanks.
If you're low on the FM dial looking for National Public Radio, go no further. We're actually going to tell you the truth here. That's our intent anyway. You're listening to Cross Examine with Frank Turek on the American Family Radio Network. You will not hear this on NPR. This kind of discussion is not welcome on NPR generally. Intelligent design, are you kidding me? That's what we're talking about with Doug Axe, A-X-E. He's a PhD. He is affiliated with the Discovery Institute in Seattle, same place Stephen Meyer and Jonathan Wells, previous guests here on Cross Examined, come from and work. And his new book is called Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. Now, Doug, I got to ask you this. I mean, what's his name? Bill Nye, the science guy, has a book called Undeniable, which is trying to say the opposite. Now, how does your book differ from his? And was anyone concerned about confusion here?
Well, they're about as different as two books could be, I think. We're both making a strong claim about something being undeniable, and one of us has to be wrong.
That's
so
right.
I recommend people read
That's
both
undeniable.
And make up their own mind.
Uh-huh.
Interesting story with the title, though. Actually, one of my daughters came up. When you write a book, you go through a whole number of titles. There's an initial one that you have when you first start writing, and then usually that's not going to be the final title. So I was at a point where I was really trying to rack my brains and getting help of others, thinking what would be a good title. And one of my daughters came up with Undeniable. She had no idea about Bill Nye's book. And so the first thing you do is you Google a title and see, well, is there another book? And up popped Bill Nye's book. And when I saw what it was about, I thought, oh, okay, I probably should not use Undeniable. But I had conversations with others, including Steve Meyer, and they said, you know, it might actually be good to use the same title because you're inviting a comparison. And I'm very willing for people to compare these two books. Bill hasn't actually done any work in this area. I'm not criticizing who he is or his educational background. He hasn't done the research that I've done. And I haven't fully read his book, but I've scanned parts of it. He seems to be just sort of parroting the things that he's heard from others. Whereas I'm trying to actually speak from my own experience and my own heart about what's true about life. So I welcome the comparison.
Now, there is a clip that you are, well, there's a clip I've used from the DVD, Darwin's Dilemma, where you're in it. And I think it's from the Journal of Molecular Biology. And it's a very powerful clip where you're describing how impossible it is to get even one protein if you took all of the resources in our galaxy and you had 13 or 14 billion years. Can you describe what that research was that you did, Doug, and what the implication of it is?
Yes, I'll have to simplify it a bit.
That's right.
A paper that came out in the Journal of Molecular Biology in 2004. And it was the culmination of years of work where I was trying to get experiments to measure how rare the sweet spot is. If you imagine an evolving system kind of trying different gene sequences and stumbling upon or hoping to stumble upon a gene that happens to encode a protein that actually folds up and forms a well-formed three-dimensional structure and does something useful. People had suspected for decades, for over a generation, that sweet spot must be very small in the space of possibilities. But nobody was able to actually put a number on it to measure it. And I did, in the end, find a way to do that, performed experiments, tried a whole bunch of random sequences and measured the fraction of them that work by messing up just small parts of an enzyme, a protein that works. Mm-hmm. If you messed up the whole thing, you wouldn't find anything that works. But if you mess up just a little part, then you can measure a fraction. And these fractions were like 1 in 100,000 or something like that, which sounds, you know, reasonable. 1 in 100,000, you should be able to find something that's that rare. But when you consider that was just a small part, like 1 part in 15 of the whole thing, then you have to do the math and multiply out that fraction. If it's 1 in 100,000 for 1/15th, then you take that and raise it to the power 15 to find out how hard it would be, how impossible it would be to find a thing that works if the whole thing were messed up. And if a random accidental search process is doing the searching that doesn't even know that it's searching, like the Darwinian process, then it would be messed up because you start with something random and you're just hoping to stumble upon something that works. Well, the number I got that's published, it's based on experimental work and some mathematical calculation, is that the sweet spot that an evolutionary process would have to hit to get a working protein that does a particular needed function is something like 1 in a trillion, 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 which is unimaginably small. Bullseye. Picture this. Picture the cross-sectional area of a hydrogen atom. That's your bullseye. And the target is a sphere that encloses the entire visible universe. A little hydrogen atom on a sphere the size of the visible universe. That's about 1 in a trillion, 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 trillion. So that's the kind of target we're talking about.
So if I was Jim Carrey, I'd say, so you're saying there's still a chance?
Yes, probably you would if you're Jim Carrey. But the rest of us know that that's not a very significant chance.
Now that was, if I remember correctly, was that, let me just put this in layman's terms, which is me. Were you saying in this experiment, Doug, or the results of this experiment, you were saying that the chances of getting just one protein was 1 in a trillion, 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 whatever. That's not even close to life. That's a protein. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah. No, you'd need hundreds of these, probably 1,000 or more, to have even a simple functional cell. Yeah. So this is just the tip of the iceberg. But what's neat about this particular problem is it's one that you could go into the lab and actually get numbers for. Of course, right. The more relevant thing is how hard is it to get an insect or how hard is it to get a dragonfly? There's just no way to get those numbers. But we do know that to get a dragonfly or an insect, you need to get lots of functional protein. So that's why I decided to look at the very smallest level of a single protein.
Now you point out in the book Undeniable, and my guest again is Doug Axe, his new book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. You point out in several places what I think needs to be pointed out again and again and again, and that has to do with the fact that natural selection cannot bring about the arrival of a species. It may help with survival, but not the arrival. Can you unpack that point for us?
Yeah, and it's not a new thing. People recognize this all the way back to Darwin's day. So Darwin came out with this theory. He made natural selection the centerpiece of his theory of origin of species. And yet the ink hadn't dried on his book before people were criticizing and saying, okay, if natural selection is what happens when an organism has something that helps it survive, then that explains why the population that this thing lives in will come to look more and more like the most successful creature in it, right? But it doesn't explain how that helpful thing arrived in the first place. It doesn't
That's
explain
right.
where it came from. Natural selection is what happens after something works, and that means it does not tell how it came to work in the first place. And people were making this complaint from the very beginning, and really, in the early 1900s, 1904, a book came out by Hugo de Vries, and he quoted someone as saying, natural selection may explain the survival of the fittest, but it does not explain the arrival of the fittest. And so that's become kind of a catchphrase that refers to this vacuum at the center of the theory. Because after all, Darwin claimed to have a theory about origins. And yet, at the very center of it, there's this hole where the actual origin of things that work is not explained.
And in fact, you write, and again, we're talking to Doug Axe, the book is Undeniable. You write this in the book Undeniable. The gaping hole in evolutionary theory is that it ascribes inventive power to natural selection alone. However, because selection can only home in on the fitness signal from an invention after that invention already exists, it can't actually invent unquote. So you're basically saying that in order for natural selection to work, there must be something there to select. Why don't people like Richard Dawkins and Jerry Coyne and other atheists see this, Doug?
That has puzzled me before, because these people are not stupid, and I would never claim that they are. Richard Dawkins is plenty bright to see this, and yet his book, and I think his masterpiece, is The Blind Watchmaker. He avoids this problem, despite the fact that he must see it. And what you end up doing if you want to avoid it is saying, well, okay, say a compound eye in insects. The Darwinist doesn't say that a mutation just produced a compound eye out of nowhere, out of thin air. They think that, you know, before the compound eye was produced, there was something else that had sort of the parts that became the compound eye, and these various things were selected for other reasons. So you tell these stories, I call them stepping stone stories in the book, where, okay, you can't get straight to this magnificent thing by mutation and selection only favors the thing once it's there, but there were these little stepping stones where step by little step, the things that were needed to make that final thing came into being, and each one was selected for its own reasons. But if you scratch your head and look at that, what it's really presupposing is that something laid out these stepping stones that lead to these fantastic inventions. And the only way to do that is if you know how to make the invention. These stepping stones themselves can't happen by accident. So it's really just, it's a shell game where the thing that everyone sees is marvelous and needs an explanation. And everyone, including Dawkins, agrees that mere coincidence is not a good explanation. But all he does is concocts a story that conceals that coincidence in the form of these stepping stones. It's as bad an explanation as just saying, why don't we just say, poof, these things appeared.
Yeah, what is the difference between a story and evidence for a story, in your view?
Well, you know, stories play a role in science, but they play a role at the very beginning where people are scratching their heads and saying, how might this have happened? Or how can we even frame a hypothesis about this? That's where storytelling and story framing can have a productive role in science. But you don't say that you're done when you've told a story. The story is really at the very, very beginning, where you start with a story and then you frame a more clear story, turn it into a hypothesis that you can actually go into the lab and test. And then when you've tested a hypothesis and shown that it's true or false, that's the point where you say you've done some science. Now we know something. Regrettably, in evolutionary biology, for generations now, it's been all about just telling a story. And then the popular story wins, and that's how you make your name.
And the evidence isn't there, and we'll see why it's not there right after the break with my guest, Doug Axe, his new book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. I'm Frank Turek. We'll be back soon. Don't go away. You're listening to Cross Examine with Frank Turek on the American Family Radio Network. We've got some live events coming up in California, North Carolina, Colorado. All that is on our website, crossexamined.org. So if you're anywhere near those places, just check our website or check out the Cross Examined app. Everything's on the app there, including this podcast, including the TV show, including the quick answer section, which will help you interact with people on the fly right there off your Windows phone, if you're one of the 12 people in the world that has one of those, your Droid or your iPhone. It's all right there in the Cross Examined app, so I hope that I can see you on the road when I'm out there. My guest today is Dr. Doug Axe, A-X-E, the book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. I read a lot of books, friends, but I don't have every author on whose book I read, because I only want to bring you the best, and Undeniable is one of the best. It's undeniable, friends. You need to read it. And Doug does a great job of bringing some complex information down to the everyday world. In fact, he has great illustrations. Doug, I want to hit on one of these illustrations that you have in the book, and it's the book of the soup. Can you explain the soup illustration to us?
Okay, I call it Oracle Soup. And so imagine this, and when you're reading the book, I tell the reader that this is, you know, experiments that came out of a laboratory of culinary science. They discovered something called Oracle soup, and it looks very much like alphabet soup, but it behaves quite differently. This is how it works. You fill a large pot with this Oracle soup, thin broth with letters and numbers, pasta letters and numbers swirling around. You cover it. You bring it to a boil. You let it cool with the lid on, and then you lift the lid once it's cooled, and you will see on the surface of the soup spelled out in pasta letters and numbers instructions for building something, something significant that functions, a complex functional device that you could get a patent for. And you take a picture of that, write it down, and if you want another patent, you just put the lid back on, bring it back to boil, and repeat as often as desired. And then as soon as I've told that, of course, you know, nobody believes it. By the time you get halfway through the story, and I say that the point of it was to show that somehow we all know that things like that can't happen. And then that really sets up in the book the asking the question, how is it that we know that these things can't happen? It's the design intuition that kicks in, and we see that, you know, a design doesn't come from nowhere, and instructions are designed. So in the story of Oracle Soup, it appears that these instructions came out of boiling soup, and we all know automatically that boiling soup cannot produce something as intelligent and complex as instructions. But I provide that up front in the book to get people to start thinking about how do we know that? And is it just an intuition, or is there some reasoning that we can build that actually shows how we know this?
And every time we see a message, friends, we realize it must come from a mind. We see John loves Mary in the sand. We know it's got to be a mind. We see take out the garbage, mom, and your alphabet cereal one morning. You know, mom prearranged those letters. Okay. This doesn't happen by chance. And this is Doug's point. Now, Doug, have you brought this up in a debate, or have you brought this kind of illustration up in a dialogue with a Darwinist? How do they respond?
I haven't had a debate on it. I think, I can't say on Oracle Soup how they would respond. I think the classical sort of response you get from Darwinists is, well, no, of course. You wouldn't expect to get that in 15 minutes. It takes you to boil soup and let soup cool down. But that's why the evolutionary process requires millions or tens or hundreds of millions of years. It's a long, cumulative process where you get one thing and one character at a time in the DNA, and eventually you have things that are as remarkable or more remarkable than instructions in soup. So it would be the Dawkins, methinks it is like a weasel kind of story, where if you have selection operating, you can take complete nonsense and turn it into Shakespeare. But of course, the flaw in that illustration is that Dawkins knew Shakespeare and was selecting for Shakespeare and supplying the information for Shakespeare in his own experiment. So that's where it all fails.
Yeah, he smuggles in intelligence. In fact, it's the old adage about, you know, how many monkeys will it take before you get Shakespeare? And Dawkins' illustration is he has a head monkey who knows Shakespeare, as you just said, who every time he gets the right letter, he preserves that letter in the string of letters to ultimately get Shakespeare. And that's the flaw in it. They're importing this intelligence, as you just mentioned, into the experiment. Now, Doug, last time I had Stephen on, well, actually, probably a couple of times when I had Stephen Meyer on, we talked about his book, which I know you contributed to, Darwin's Doubt. And there was a revelation in there for me I hadn't heard of before. Called epigenetic information. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that epigenetic information, which can't be modified by mutations, is absolutely essential for new life forms, which means you can mutate DNA from now till doomsday. You'll never get a new life form. Can you unpack that for us? Because I think you use an illustration of an iPhone 5 transitioning to an iPhone 6. And I think that may hit or that may deal with epigenetic information, the structure of the thing that's being modified. Can you unpack that for us a little bit?
It's become more and more clear to biologists that DNA is not the only thing running the show. And in the framing of what's become called neo-Darwinism. So Darwin didn't know about DNA in 1859, but in the early 20th century, as it became more and more clear that DNA was an information-carrying molecule, there was a reframing of Darwin's theory in terms of DNA as the genetic material, the thing that gets inherited. And the idea was that mutations to DNA are completely sufficient to rewrite the blueprint of life and create all the diversity of life that we see. Mm-hmm. What's become clear since that time, so that's like, mid-20th century, is that DNA is not the only thing directing the development of organisms. There seems to be quite a bit of information that's coming from outside of the DNA. So that's what Steve was referring to. You cannot expect to make new life forms by mutating DNA if much of the information by which they attain their adult forms is not in the DNA. And we don't know exactly where it is, but it certainly isn't in the DNA. So that's the idea. And the same idea with my illustration with the iPhone. If you have an iPhone 5 or a 6 and you want to upgrade, you can upgrade your software because there you're just changing the information. That's analogous to changing the DNA of an organism. But that obviously won't upgrade your phone to the next hardware phone. You have to change the hardware as well.
So the analogy says that the DNA is like the software of the phone, whereas the epigenetic information is like the hardware of the phone. And you can mutate the software all you want. You're never going to get a new iPhone. Is that the point?
Correct. It can be more complicated than that even in biology, because there are instances where it seems as though things outside of the DNA actually can influence the DNA. And that doesn't happen in an iPhone. You have this very clear division in human-made devices between the software and the hardware, and the software doesn't modify the hardware, and the hardware doesn't modify the software.
Now this is really revolutionary, Doug. I mean, what you just said there, if taken to heart, and if it's really true, and of course I believe it is, I have no reason to doubt you, it's what Stephen Meyer's been saying and others, that means that the neo-Darwinian thesis is wrong. It can't. There's no way you can get a new life form by merely mutating DNA. Am I right about drawing that conclusion here?
Yeah, and I think you could draw that conclusion in a number of just different ways. And in fact, the last time that I was on your program with Steve Meyer, we were talking about this interesting meeting in London back in November. And a number of the people who are not at all favoring design say that same thing, that the DNA is not enough, that a theory of biological origins that's only talking about mutations to DNA cannot capture much of what we know about biology.
Now, that's earth-shattering, and that's why the Royal Society meeting, which occurred in November of 2016, where Doug, he attended, as did Stephen Meyer and others from the Discovery Institute, that's why that whole meeting was called. These are not intelligent design proponents. These are Darwinists who are calling the meeting saying, we've got a problem. The neo-Darwinian, let's just mutate DNA. That theory is not going to give us new life forms. And Doug, how close did any of these people get to suggesting maybe intelligence is part of it?
Well, it's interesting. That came up on more than one occasion, or someone would use the term intelligence, and someone would get furious and say, are you saying, no, I'm not saying that. So it's kind of fun to sit back and watch the fireworks. I wasn't giving a talk. We weren't invited to give talks.
Uh-huh.
We were just watching, patiently watching, and it was clear that there's tension in the house, let's put it that way, and people are vying for priority in terms of whose theory, should we change the name of the theory? Should we replace neo-Darwinism and say that there's a new synthesis? And some people were saying yes, and some people were saying no. All the while, the intelligent design advocates in the audience were thinking, I think the change needs to be more radical than any of you people are thinking about.
It's amazing that when it's possible that someone could be possibly suggesting an intelligent designer, it's that people get all bothered about that. And I think it's because the intelligent designer brings morality with him. I mean, Richard Dawkins has admitted, and so has Lawrence Krauss, that one could make a good case for a deistic God. He said, well, it's not, Dawkins said, it's not a God I would ascribe to, or it's not a thesis I would make. But you could make a reasonably good case that there's a creator out there who created the universe. He just doesn't get involved with us. You see, it seems to me getting involved with us is where they really have a problem, Doug. In your experience, have you seen that?
Yes. And, you know, I have that atheist bus campaign photograph, Dawkins. I'm trying to find it in my book here. Toward the end of my book, I can't remember
what he says
on that.
Where he says there probably is no God.
There's probably no God, so carry on and enjoy your life or something like
that. That's right.
Stop worrying and enjoy your life. And when I first saw that, I thought, that means that the thought of God being real must cause people like Richard Dawkins to worry. And why does it make him worry?
Yeah, that's a good point. In fact, after the break, I want to bring up this issue of objectivity. Are scientists always objective? Do they view biology through a certain kind of lens? Are there gatekeepers in mainstream science? More with my guest, Doug Axe, right after this.
If you find value in the content of this podcast, don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you can find more. Just type CrossExamine or Frank Turek on the search bar. Also, visit our website where we add new videos, articles, and free resources daily.
You know, friends, every year, the best apologetics conference perhaps in the world happens in Charlotte, North Carolina, right where I am now. It's put on by Southern Evangelical Seminary, my alma mater, SES.edu. It's October, I think it's October 13th. It's always the second weekend in October. I will be there. There'll be several other speakers there, including my guest today, Doug Axe. His new book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. So you need to pick up that book. And if you're anywhere near Charlotte, we've had people who travel from Michigan to come to this thing. I mean, they'll drive 12 hours to be at this conference. There's going to be a lot of great speakers, so you're not going to want to miss it. You got plenty of time to prepare. It's in October. Myself, Doug Axe, many others will be there. So I hope you can make that in October. Now, Doug, before the break, we were talking about this question of objectivity. And I don't know why the general public thinks that scientists are always objective, that somehow their motives are always pure. The question is, are scientists always on a relentless pursuit of truth? Are they immune to peer pressure and the temptations associated with money, sex, and power, just like the rest of us? Or are they immune from that? I mean, it seems to me that normal people are tempted by certain things, but for some reason, the general public thinks, no, that never happens in science. These people are always clearly objective. They're always going for the truth. Is that always the case, that they're always going for the truth?
You know, it sounds silly when you put it that way, because when you put it that way, people say, well, no, they can't really be any different from the rest of us. But I think happens is we've been told about something called the scientific method since we were young, and we kind of naively think that somehow that method cleans all the dirtiness out of science. And so, yes, you can have individual scientists who are flawed as humans, but somehow in the method, all those flaws get washed out and you get pure and pristine science coming out of it. But you don't have to think about that very long to think, well, hang on, how could that possibly be? Or think about all the other human endeavors where there's a noble objective, like in criminal justice, there's a noble objective. Even in business, there's a noble objective. In medicine, there's a noble objective. But when you get a bunch of people together trying to pursue the noble objective, they're also trying to pursue other things, their own career advancement, their own wealth, their own power. And it becomes a mess. It becomes a politically tainted, complex human mess. It's not that people entirely lose sight of the noble objective. It's that their own selfish objectives really are paramount in any individual, or usually are paramount in any one individual. And these systems aren't as self-corrective as we'd like to think they are. Look at politics. I mean, things get off in the wrong direction. It becomes virtually impossible for them to be truly corrected. I mean, there are better ways of governing and worse ways of governing, clearly, but they're all tainted by, you know, the human factor. And science is the same thing. It's a human enterprise. It's a bunch of flawed people who are trying to make their mark. And in some instances, they're more interested in, you know, they're more interested in in elevating their own name in making their mark than they are in discovering the truth. It actually takes a fair amount of humility, if you think about it, to pursue something where you really genuinely want to know what's true, and you're willing to admit that you got it wrong if you got it wrong. Scientists are human. They don't want to admit that they got it wrong, and they don't want to say, you know what, the last 40 years I've spent on this, I was pursuing it wrong. We were going down a blind alley. Thank you for showing us that we were wrong. They don't respond that way.
Yes, I've said it 100 times on this show. Science doesn't say anything. Scientists do. And quite frequently, scientists, they gather and interpret the data based upon a certain lens. Now, what is the lens in mainstream biology today, Doug?
So a lens is like a worldview, a way of understanding reality. And the common worldview in the sciences is called materialism, or slightly more broadly, naturalism. Materialism is the idea that there isn't anything other than the stuff that physicists study. So atoms and molecules, matter, energy, space and time, that's the sum total of all that exists. And if you want to name something that you think isn't that, then these scientists will say, well, we can show you that actually you're wrong. It does reduce to those things. So you might say, well, God is not atoms or molecules or space or time or matter or energy. And of course, the scientific answer to that would be that God is an invention of the human mind, and the human mind is something that evolved. And so it all does come down to matter and energy.
Mm. Which defeats, of course, their own position, because if the human mind evolved and it's completely controlled by the laws of physics, then why should we think their theories about the human mind are true, and about God, and about evolution, and about everything? And you point this out, Doug, in the book Undeniable. My guest is Doug X, Undeniable. You have a chapter or two in the back where you really get into the philosophical flaws in materialism. And I think you do a great job at it.
Yeah, you know, that was actually, I mentioned some of my own history of how I got into this, these kinds of big questions. It really started with the question of mind. As an undergraduate at Berkeley, I was studying the physical sciences and thinking that they were very elegant, but also seeing that there's no way that a human being could be reduced to these physical laws, because if we are, then we don't have free will. And if we don't have free will, it seemed to me we couldn't be conscious, because it seemed to me that consciousness and free will are two things that go together. You either believe both of them or you end up throwing them both out. And I was a firm believer in consciousness and in the reality of conscious experience and free will. I couldn't even conceive at the time that anyone could deny those things. And so it seemed to me that there's a simple proof that materialism can't be true. Although atoms and molecules and matter and energy and space and time are all real, they can't be the sum total of all that exists. Because if we're thinking and if we're consciously aware, then that has to be outside of this physical structure of the universe. And I wrote, you know, a little essay. I didn't send it anywhere. I didn't publish it. I found a copy of it as an undergraduate, just articulating that argument. And I think it's a valid argument, and people have to go through all kinds of mental gymnastics to try to get out of that, arguing that no, consciousness is some sort of epiphenomenon. The brain is what is controlling our behavior, not the mind. But why, you know, if we're robots, why are we aware? Because consciousness seems superfluous if we're just machines. And in the book, I show that, in fact, all of our reasoning dissolves away if you take that view and insist that we are nothing but material, because we think in concepts, and concepts are just plain not material. So either we're completely wrong about everything we're thinking, or thought is not a material process.
And if reason is impossible on materialism, then so is science, because you can't do science without reason. You see,
absolutely.
The universal acid is not Darwin. The universal acid is Darwin, but it's really more materialism. That just burns through everything. If materialism is true, we can't be sure about anything. We can't think about anything. In fact, you write in the book, in Undeniable, you write this: the brain is the one physical invention that serves as an interface between the physical and conceptual worlds. Unpack that for us. That's an amazing thought right there. Unpack that for us, Doug.
Well, we all believe in the physical world, and it's elegant in its mathematical structure. But if we're going to affirm this process of thinking and engaging the world, then we're affirming that there's also this immaterial, non-physical world that's just as real, in fact, more real, and that's this world of consciousness, of concept, of thought. The world that we actually inhabit is this conscious world of mind, and in that world, we're looking out on this physical world. So what is the point at which these two worlds meet? Well, it's in our heads, in the gray matter here, in this marvelous complex structure of the brain. We must have a place where the physical stimuli, when I look at something, there's photons landing on my retina, there's a electrical signal that's sent through my optic nerve into the brain, into the part of the brain that's processing visual signal. And somewhere in that trillions and trillions of neural connections, a physical signal is handed over to an immaterial me, the mind, the soul that's actually grasping this and seeing the thing and going, oh, that's my wife, or oh, there's a cat. Mm. And we have no idea scientifically how that works, but it must be that way in order for us to make sense out of this. So it's in our brains, is this interface between the physical and the mental, and that is the most crucial, I argue, those are the most significant physical centers in this entire universe. Even though they make up a very small part of this physical universe, it's these human minds with the brain by which they're seeing the world that mean everything.
And this is why Thomas Nagel, whom you write about in the book, the atheist from NYU, has really created a firestorm in the atheistic world by suggesting that, well, not suggesting, he basically says the neo-Darwinian view of the universe is almost certainly false. And here's a guy, Doug, who admits he doesn't want there to be a God. He says, I have a cosmic authority problem. It's not just that I don't believe in God. I don't want there to be a God. Right. And he writes this, and you quote him in the book. He says, one of the tendencies it supports, meaning reductionism, materialism, is the ludicrous overuse of evolutionary biology to explain everything about life, including everything about the human mind. That just can't be, as you point out, Doug. Evolution can't even explain biology. To explain the human mind as well is just ludicrous, as Nagel would put it. Doug, we're about out of time, but this book, Undeniable, is wonderful. I just want to thank you for being on the show and for writing this book.
It was a pleasure to write it, and it's even more a pleasure to interact with people over it.
Well, this book needs to get a wider audience. I know it's done quite well, but it needs to go even higher on the chart. So, friends, pick up a copy of Undeniable by Doug Axe, my guest today, AXE. It's very readable. It's very relevant. It's very important. You need to pick up a copy. Undeniable. It's Undeniable, friends. It's a great book. So check it out. I'm Frank Turek. I'll see you here next week. God bless. See you.